Jeffrey Round, it dawned on me when I had to think about who to have as my final guest on Queer Rise of Crime. And when your name came up, I was so angry at myself because I thought Jeff should have instantly have come to mind. Without any hesitation, hands down, it had to be you, my friend. We have a lot to talk about today. In addition to your current work in progress, I'm going to talk about some other topics that we haven't touched on the past two times that you have been on the show. For one, this is the 25th anniversary of your acclaimed novel, A Cage of Bones. We have never talked about that novel. We've never talked about you being a model, which kind of was the basis for that novel. We've never touched on the things that you've done in film. So we have a lot of things to talk about. So what do you say we talk about those things?
Well, first off, I'd just like to say thank you for having me as this special guest on a very special show. I greatly appreciate it. You and I always have a great time talking, so I'm thrilled to talk about whatever you want to talk about.
And that's usually what we end up doing anyway.
It is.
Either you take off or I take off, one way or another. The reason I want to talk about A Cage of Bones is this is the 25th anniversary, as I said. And when it came out, it took the world by storm. And it was named on After Elton's Top 100 Greatest Gay Books in 2008. And it just happened to be your first novel. So that is not our first published novel, at least. That doesn't happen to most people. So let's get to it right after this.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shree.
Okay, Jeffrey Round, once again, it is nice to have you as my guest here on Queer Writers of Crime. As you folks hopefully know, I am Brad Shreve, and I'm going to get a touch sappy. I told myself I wasn't going to get maudlin in these final days of the show, but I'm going to say one of the great joys of doing this show over the past 3 years are the friendships that I have developed with so many authors and other individuals, and it is not something that I expected. And yours is one I truly cherish, and I am so glad that I've gotten to know you. You allow me to whine at times. You don't hesitate to bust my ass if you read something I wrote and you think it could be better. I hate you, and I thank you for that. And I'll tell you, when I started this podcast, there were many unexpected benefits. I frequently get works long before publication. Richard Stevenson sent me Knock Off the Hat way before Lawrence Block has sent me his upcoming novel. He's not even a queer writer. He sent me his upcoming novel way in advance. And you sent me your upcoming novel. And I'm so happy that I have that luxury. And I'm going to miss that. I hope it continues anyway, no matter what. So we're going to talk about that novel. But before we do that, handsome, we're going to talk about your modeling career, because we've never discussed this at all. When did it begin and how long did you do it?
It began roughly in 1985. It began seriously in 1985. I had a boyfriend just prior to that who said, "Wow, you've got great cheekbones. Why don't you send your photographs into a modeling agency?" And for a lark, I did. And lo and behold, they said, "Come on in. We want to see you." And they said, "Okay, we're signing you up." And within 6 months, they had sent me to Italy to work for an affiliate agency there called My Models Milan. And it didn't last a lot after that, I think, maybe off and on for about 4 years. Models don't have a long, you know, span of time in which they are considered, you know, fresh. So I did it for mostly for fun. I met a couple of people who became friends who actually made a lot of money. I was never fortunate enough to grab like a major campaign, anything like that. But I had a lot of fun and I met a lot of fun people, just the way you do with your radio show. You just said, "Let's put it out there, reach out, see what happens." And lo and behold, people gravitate to you and say, "Oh, you're kind of a cool guy. Let's hang out for a bit." So there's that. There's an analogy there between the two, between what you've done and how you reached out and how I got to spread, you know, spread my wares.
Well, if I'm correct, the very handsome man on the cover of A Cage of Bones right now is you. Am I correct?
If you have the second edition, there are two editions. The first one is Not Me. That was the Gay Men's Press version. And that was another model who I never met. But the picture on the second edition is me. And the reason it's me is because it was a free cover.
Well, it was a good choice because I looked at it and I'm like, that's Jeff. And he's hot. I mean, you're still very hot, I will tell you that.
97 today.
Well, you look incredibly great for your age.
Thank you. Thank you.
Wow, you held up well.
I tell myself that all the time.
Because I don't know if you know this, I'm 19.
I was going to go with 20, but I didn't want to push it.
This is what drugs and alcohol will do to you. I'm really only 19. So, but you know, A Cage of Bones doesn't shine a very good light on the modeling industry. And I'm thinking that may have come from somewhere. Is there reality in what you have in that novel? And am I right about the way you portray it?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm looking for the dramatic aspects, the intriguing aspects, the colorful things about the industry. I met and worked with a lot of really good quality people who I would be proud to call friends. But there was always the backstory, the backstage things, the drugs, the alcohol. Not so much. I didn't see anything, though I was told it happened, that was in any way sexually, manipulative, but certainly I heard stories about it. So that's the background that I chose. And because my story is sort of quasi, I don't want to call it a tragedy, but it does have a dark turn towards the end. I didn't want, you know, everything to be light and fluffy and fun all the way through it. And then suddenly, boom, you've got something quite serious happening towards the end of the book. So that was what I chose to dwell on.
Did you know when it came out and got so much attention, did you know that that was special?
It got attention from certain quarters, but it didn't get it in other places that I was hoping it might. So to a degree, I interestingly enough, I made a couple of friends because of the novel, one of whom was Chaim Salvadori. I was working at Extra magazine here, the queer press in Canada, and did a profile on him and said, hey, by the way, my book's coming out. Do you want to blurb it? And he did and wrote me an amazing blurb. And we became close for a while after that. We've kind of drifted apart. I mean, it's, you know, 25 years later. But it did bring me close to a number of people, some of whom I admired greatly. Another one was Douglas LePan, who was both a poet and a novelist. He was the first writer to win both the governor. We have something called the Governor General's Award up here, which might be like your Pulitzer Prize or something. It's for poetry and it's for fiction. And he was the first writer to win both. A couple of decades apart. I think he won it, the first one in the 40s and the second one in the 1960s. And he and I became friends for the rest of his life. He didn't live that much longer after we knew each other, I think another 7 years, but we got to be very close. So the novel had an effect in many, many ways on my life and as well as on my writing.
Well, the fact that this year, because it's 25 years, you went back to England and toured some of the sites that inspired you for that novel. If you told me it didn't have an impact on you, I would tell you were a liar.
I will not tell you that, Brad.
When you went back, was there anything that you were searching for in that trip?
What was I searching for? You know, I think I asked myself that a few times along the way and didn't really have a definitive answer. It's not like I was searching for my lost youth or anything quite so, you know, tawdry. I was searching for the spirit that impelled me to write the novel, because when I was there, in 95 and you know, subsequent years I went back, I wasn't writing a novel. I was working in a profession, basically. So I wasn't thinking along those terms, but I kept a diary. And when I decided, oh, I'm going to turn my adventures into a novel, that's when I went back to the diary. And the spirit that I find in that diary, when I go to it now, I think, oh, okay, that was a really interesting guy. I don't think I'm him anymore, but I think I would like him still. So when I went back to England, specifically England, I mean, in the book, half the book takes place in Italy, half the book takes place in England. Mm-hmm. I think I was looking for that spirit more than anything else. And I would say that writing-wise, I feel most free and inspired when I'm traveling. So that has a lot to do with it.
Yeah, I think I've heard you say that before. That's interesting. But I did hear something funny about the book, or I read something funny about the book. And that is, when you first wrote it, it was 1,000 pages.
Yes.
And your editor got you to cut it back to 300?
I didn't have an editor. They kept throwing me out the door. I said, get out of here. 1,000 pages, you're crazy. So I didn't really do any. I sent it out again and again and again. I was very naive at the time. And when it didn't sell after a couple of years, I thought, well, you know, I know it's a good book. What's the problem? And then I thought, okay, there aren't any books of that length by first-time authors. Not really. Maybe one in a million. So I thought, okay, what is the core of the story? Because I had a lot of backstory, and then I had a lot of front story. At the time, if it had come out, and I'm glad it didn't because it wasn't ready to be published, if it had come out, it would have been possibly the very first AIDS novel to be published. Mm-hmm. It's not an AIDS book at all now. That was the end of the story turned into an AIDS story. So it was a very, very different story. But when I looked at it, I thought, what is the core of this? What is at the heart? And I thought, okay, this naive kid from Canada goes to Europe, gets involved in the modeling industry, gets in a lot of trouble, and what happens to him? And I thought, okay, that 300 of the 1,000 pages that I have written, can I cut it down to that? And once I realized that, it was easy to do that. And that's when the real book took shape. I'm sure you've heard the expression, kill your darlings. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of darlings I had to kill off in that early book.
Yeah,
I think we all do, don't we?
The reason it made me laugh is 1,000 pages is about 250,000 words, give or take. That's more than most fantasy novels. Fantasy readers wouldn't read that. And you had no clue that it was bloated.
No, because I loved every word, every sentence, every paragraph, every chapter. So, you know, what are you going to do? You have a lot of darlings and you love them all, but you have to get sensible and say, okay, I can't feed them all, you know, to feed them all, I have to cut them down by about 2/3.
Do you have the original copy for your own enjoyment?
I do.
Oh, good for you. Good for you. Maybe you could change it a little bit and publish that as a sci-fi novel. Then the 250,000 words won't surprise too many people. So I got to say, one of the reasons I've really connected with you is you have this like incredible zest for life. And you have so many different interests. You've made films, you're a singer, you're a songwriter, you're a poet, you're an author, you've written and directed plays, you've traveled around the world. And I'm not making your life sound like all rainbows and unicorns. I mean, we've talked about some difficult times in your life. I know the past year you've seen a lot of death in your life, and we've talked about that. And I know your mother passed away. But you're always off to one thing or another, and you are beyond excited in almost everything that you do when you tell me about it. So I am going to do a little armchair psychology here, because in some of your songs, in some of your poems, I feel sadness. And I recently watched your short film, My Heart Belongs to Daddy, and it was interesting and fun to watch. It's a little twisted, or it has a good twist, I should say. But I got from the film a lot of sadness and anger. Do you have this very vibrant outward appearance because you have outlets to channel the negative shit?
I'm not quite sure what you're asking. Maybe you could rephrase that.
It seems in a lot of your work, I see a darker side of you.
Yes.
One that isn't always excited about life. And if anybody talks to you for a few minutes, they're like, wow, this guy, he just has it all. He's always happy. He's always so excited to do things. And then I read your poetry and I watch your short film and I see a different side of Jeff. Am I right?
Okay. Oh, absolutely. I'm just trying to grapple with the outer happy self that you're talking about. I think I know what you're talking about. I get excited connecting with people. I get excited communicating. And those are things I love to do. So you see the happy side. That they are probably driven far more than I even realize by the darker, the inner self that is not happy and that is quite frequently angry about a lot of things. I try to come to terms with the sadness and with the anger, and I think that's perhaps why I write. Does that answer the question, or am I just...
No, you're right there. Because My Heart Belongs to Daddy, 20 minutes long. You did it back in 2003, but it has its dark side, for sure.
Yeah.
Your latest book of poetry, Threads, there's some darkness in there too. So I just saw a trend in your art that I don't necessarily see when I see your face.
Ah, okay. And thank you for that. You can bill me for the psychotherapy. In Threads, as if you've read it, you know that there are four poems about suicide, two of whom are actual suicides. One was Sylvia Plath's son, Nick, and another was a colleague, R.M. Vaughan, a Canadian writer who killed himself in 2020, I believe. And the other two are about, one is about, I think, I never tell a reader what to think, but in my mind, it's about somebody contemplating and then taking the act to commit suicide after the breakup of a relationship. And the other one, wow, what's the other one? I know there are four. The other one is probably the most important of the four, to a would-be LGBTQ teen suicide. These are very serious thoughts. I don't take them lightly. I want to talk about them. I've never really hesitated talking about the things that other people think are kind of scary. I'm getting really interesting feedback from that book in particular, Threads. People saying, wow, that was really revealing. And I could never do something like that in my writing. But I'm very impressed that you have. So I'm not getting negative feedback saying, oh, that's a bunch of crap. Why are you talking about your problems? I'm getting feedback from people saying, I wish I could do that. I think there have been times in my life when I couldn't. As a teenager, I really didn't have a lot of people I could talk to until I went to university and met some good friends. So there were a lot of very, very dark times during which I was potentially suicidal. And those are the times when I couldn't talk about those things. So to a would-be LGBTQ teen suicide was written many, many years after the contemplation. In the poem, I talk about going down to the waterfront and contemplating throwing myself in. Mm-hmm. That was true. It happened more than once. It was like 2-3 times. And I just thought, nah, I don't really think I'm a drowning kind of suicide. I don't think I can do that. So I did pull back, thankfully. And life did get better. That year I came out. And I came out to someone, so I was 18, because I had started university when I was 17. Again, I was a misfit. I was too young to be in university. The following year, I came out to someone who was still one of my closest friends, and she was the very first person I said, oh, I'm gay. And then we talked, and suddenly, you know, 500 pounds of weight came off in a few minutes, and it changed everything. It really changed everything. I think there have been times when I've been unable or unwilling to talk. And since then, not really. I'm going to tell you something kind of funny, actually. It just happened to me. As you said, my mother passed away last year in April 2021. I inherited from her, apart from, you know, some very nice material things, I got a suitcase full of mementos that I was afraid to go into until this morning. I went in this morning. One of the things I found, she had archived things about my brothers. So there's a little folder for each of my two brothers, and then one for me. And I pulled out, one of the things I pulled out from the file for me was a report card when I was probably about maybe 10 years old, something like that. And I was very surprised to see the comment the teacher had put was, we do wish he would curb his talkativeness. I don't remember being a chatterbox in school.
It doesn't surprise me. I don't consider you a chatterbox, but you never seem to run out of things to say.
Quite true. Quite true. If I ever stop talking, I don't know what would happen.
And I got to say, if anybody ever said that what you had in Threads was crap, I would be shocked. The teen suicide one is beautiful in the sense that it's incredibly powerful.
Thank you.
Yeah. At the end of my show notes in every episode, I have a link to the Trevor Project. I have such great faith in that organization. And you just talking about that particular poem made me think of them as, again, I wish there was no need for them and other organizations like it. But
yes, yes. I just saw online the list of banned books from the U.S. and I thought, okay, that's going to shut down a lot of lines of communication.
Even math books. I don't even know why. Just the way things, some math problems are written, they had to ban math books.
Oh, because they're sexually suggestive or what?
I have no idea. I'm sure it has something to do with culture or race or sex or something. Who knows? I've never actually read them. I probably should, but I didn't want to get that deep into it. It would make me too furious, I guess is what it comes down to. Not that I'm trying to ignore the problem. I just don't need to know every single detail. I know that the problem exists. So let's talk about your upcoming book.
Sure.
It's a ways off. It's not available to order or pre-order. I don't want to give anybody the pretense that it is, but we can talk a bit about it. And the name of it is The Sulphur Springs Cure. And you said you started this as a mystery, but your editor said no.
No, my editor didn't say no. He said, what if? And I far prefer that.
Okay. What if?
Yes. So the book was written, maybe started around 2010, finished around 2012, something like that. It was a mystery. It's about an older woman. She's in her 80s, who goes back to the scene of a crime that she was connected with when she was 14 years old. So she's going back 70 years. The Sulphur Springs Cure of the title, the inspiration for it came when I visited a place near Hamilton, Ontario. It's actually outside of Dundas, Ontario, if anybody knows where that is. Very small place. But there was a Sulphur Springs, a hot springs, that in the 1920s and 30s was very popular. It was considered a cure for arthritis and rheumatism and all kinds of things. And it was a place that people flocked to from around North America, certainly, and potentially from farther. But the war sort of put an end to it. I take off my story from that point. I didn't, because the place burned down at some point, so it's not really there. But you can, the sulfur springs are still there. You can actually go up and there's a little monument with a tap. You can turn the tap on, the sulfur water comes out. But I just had this feeling like I was walking in the footsteps of people from a long time ago, and what could have happened there and what might have happened there. And I coupled this with a desire to write a book for my mother that was, how shall I say, not as controversial as some of the books that I'm known for. So I didn't want to add a lot of, I tried to write it solely without any sex scenes whatsoever. I was not entirely successful in the first draft, the mystery, but I did limit it to one very brief sex scene. And then I couldn't sell it. The other books had taken off by then, the Dan Sharp books, and everybody wanted the gay mysteries. And this was not a gay mystery. This was about, you know, kind of a Miss Marple type of a woman in her 80s going back to see what really happened, because the mystery was never solved. The murder was never solved, though there were suspects. So she goes back to see what was going on there. Mm-hmm. So I sent it out to a couple of places, and I thought, no, I'll just leave it. You know, its time will come around. And last year, publisher did say, do you have something, maybe a mystery, something kind of light? I'm looking for a space to fill in my roster. And this novel came back to me. I thought, oh, okay, maybe this is going to be it. So I sent it to him, not really expecting much, because I thought it was a very slight book, but a fun mystery. There's a good twist at the end. And he came back to me and said, I think you wrote a literary novel with a mystery in it. And my mind just went boom, wow, what I could do with that. And at that point, I thought, well, I had written it for my mother, but she is gone now, so I can do whatever I want with it and not worry about how heavy it gets. I remember I had a trip planned to Europe at the time. I was going back to London, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to sit every day in the British Library and write this thing and see what comes out of it. And what came out of it was a very different type of book. I basically rewrote all the prose because it's no longer just very basic. I don't quite know how to describe it, but the sentences were no longer as basic as they had been because I was trying to write something a little bit elevated in tone. And that suited the characters much more than what I had originally written, because I was kind of pigeonholing them into being in, they were stuck in a novel they didn't really want to be in, is how I would phrase it now. And so I liberated them. I gave them wings and let them fly in a different direction. And by the time I sat back, I thought, oh wow, this is a very different book. And I'm now going to submit this to my publisher, not as a mystery, but as a literary novel. So that I have just done.
And I find the term literary novel interesting. How do you define a literary novel?
Okay, because I am a big supporter and defender of what is called genre. And people seem to have this impression that literature is one thing and all genre is another. And I would say, no, anything can be literary. You can call it a literary mystery. You can call it a literary thriller, whatever you want. I mean, there are many, many authors out there who do this sort of thing. The one who comes to mind is Margaret Atwood, who is now writing literary speculative fiction, mm-hmm. some of which I've read. So that's a cross border thing. But what I tell people is every book is its own genre. And if you want to categorize certain books along with other books into genres, say, okay, so those are branches on a tree, but none of them is more important than any other. So how would I define literature? I think in the most basic sense that I pay a lot more attention. No, I'm even contradicting myself here. I always pay attention to words because I come at words from a poet's perspective. I don't want to say that one style is better than another, but I think there's a self-consciousness about a literary style that perhaps a mystery will tend to hide if it has it. You don't want people thinking about the words on the page so much. You want them thinking about the characters. You want them thinking about the plot line. But to add that other element, that self-consciousness of style, when you can do it, when it doesn't feel awkward and when it doesn't feel forced, I think that's getting close to what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's interesting. The reason I asked is Garrick Jones is a mystery writer, and I told him one day, you know, your novels are literary novels. And I said that not really even sure if I know what the definition of a literary novel is. It's kind of like, I don't know what it is, but I know it when I read it kind of thing. And it was funny because his response was, that's what my editor said. I want to be a mystery writer. And fortunately, he writes literary novels that have good mysteries in them. And he will probably kill me that I even said that because he wants them to be mystery novels. That all being said, you mentioned that they asked you for something that was kind of light. And actually, I did find this, there is some light moments in this book. In fact, right at the beginning, there's a line that it made me giggle. I found it memorable. And it was, there will be little left but memories once she disposes of the property and relocates to McPickle Residence for Seniors. And I stopped there and I'm like, why did he give that such a comedic name? And then I read, just thinking of that name rankles her. She might as well be pickled once she moves there. I'm like, that's why he chose such a perfect name.
It is. And again, that, you know, that I don't think at the time my mother was in a retirement home, but she was not long after. And I had certainly spent, you know, time visiting people in retirement homes. My experience of them, even when they're nice, my mother lived in a really nice residence. She was privileged to do that. They're not places that I am particularly fond of. Yeah, that's an example. I mean, she has a very I don't know what the word for it is. Here's the writer grappling for words, right? I don't want to say catty sense of humor, but very wry sense of humor. She's always looking at the twist in things. This character, Violet McPherson, is always looking at the twist in things. My mother had a rather heavy sense of humor. She blew me up a few times with her comments on things. I don't think she realized how heavy they were. I think she just thought she was being funny. For instance, my first book, after she'd read it, she put it down and said, "Well, you used a lot of $2 words." So Violet would say something like that. Violet, I made Violet a little bit more subtle because I just, you know, when my mother said these things, they were like a whammy. Violet, I wanted her just, I like it when people can't look at her and think, is she being funny or is she being serious? So they can't really tell.
Well, let's talk about Violet. She is the protagonist. You kept referring to her as the old lady or the older lady. She's 84, and this novel it's a 70-year gap. Well, the story begins when she's 84 and goes back and forth. Tell us more about Violet.
Which
10 years ago, what was in Jeffrey Round's brain that says, I'm going to write about an 84-year-old woman?
That's, Brad, that's such a long time ago in writer time. I've written so many books since then. What was in my brain? I always try to entertain my readers no matter what I'm reading. Mm-hmm. I never want anybody to be bored with the characters, with the plot, with the prose, especially. Even when I say, oh, this is my version of literary prose, I never want anybody to say, oh, God, that was hard to get through, or boy, you used a lot of $2 words. That style has changed a lot from my first book. But I find that sometimes older women get lost, whether it's in movies or in books. And I thought, no, they're sparkling and they're funny and they're really wise a lot of the time, especially the ones, you know, have actually lived that long. So I thought, this is the kind of person that would give an outlet to my sense of humor and my sensibility if I could put her in a book and let her speak, not for me, but I have to say a lot of the times now when I go look back after, you know, 10 years later, I think, yeah, that's me zinging somebody. But I like it through her perspective. She's allowed to get away with it because she is a senior. Whereas I might get, you know, knocked off my pedals, say, who the fuck do you think you are? So it was fun to give her a lot of lines that where she really got in a good sucker punch to a few people.
Well, one thing I'm curious about, I know you wrote this 10 years ago, but it's gone through some rewrites since then. You wrote this at a different time in your life than when you wrote the Dan Sharp mysteries. You wrote it at a different time in your life than when you did the Bradford Fairfax mysteries. It's a different time of your life than when you wrote A Cage of Bones. Are there differences that we'll see that are noticeable in your style or the type of story?
Well, yes. And what would those be, Jeffrey? I'm trying to inhabit the mind of an 84-year-old woman looking back on her 14-year-old self and thinking, oh my God, this kid was such a precocious little brat, because she has been haunted her entire life by this murder, this mystery that happened when she was 14, that she feels in a way she helped trigger it because of something she does in the book. She is looking back at this younger person saying, wow, I'm so glad I'm not that person now, but wasn't she an awful little kid? And I would smack her now. So you're probably not allowed to say things like that. No, but that's what she is looking back on from the perspective of 70 years and thinking, how could I have done those things? You know, and we're all responsible for what we do when we're younger, but we no longer feel the connection to what it is that made us do those things. And I think that is what she is looking for. She's looking for absolution in a sense. She wants some kind of redemption to say, if I can solve this, or if I can find a way that I'm not quite as responsible as I thought I was, wouldn't that be a good thing? But I'm not going to shirk my duty. I will not say I was not part of this. So there's guilt. There's a lot of guilt riding on this. And that's one of the things. I mean, that's I do have other characters, older women. The war novel about Bosnia, The Honey Locust, the mother in that was an older woman, but she was in her 60s at the time. But I think that's the main thing, is I'm trying to get into the head of a character and make her real, someone who is definitely not me biologically, certainly not, and chronologically, because she was born in whenever she was born, I guess, around the late 1920s. So she would have been my mother's age, basically.
So was it wanting to write this type of character that was the catalyst to write this novel?
No, the catalyst was really that visit, walking through those meadows and seeing the sulfur springs and feeling all these ghostly presences rising up. And I'm thinking, who were these people? What were they doing here? How did their lives work out? And the name, I think this is partly where the character sprang from. The name was on a plaque, a memorial of some sort, of someone who had given money to this park, this memorial park, and her name was literally Violet. And that immediately put me back 100 years. I thought, well, nobody's named Violet now, though mm-hmm. a friend of mine did name her child Violet about 15 years ago. But that said somebody from that time. And I thought, okay, well, that's what's interesting. That's what I'm feeling, these ghosts from this time. In this particular instance, it's August 1939. It's right before the beginning of the Second World War that everything happens. And then it all just gets obliterated by the Second World War. Everybody stops worrying about who got murdered and when and why and who did what to whom. So it all gets buried for 70 years. So she has lived with this secret for 70 years. She thinks, I'm not going to be around much longer. I want to do something about this before I'm gone.
I don't know why this jumped out at me. It's funny because when you said nobody's named Violet anymore, flower names were really common in the past.
Yes.
I'm not writing right now, but I am note-taking for a novel I'm going to write that takes place in 1920. And there's a woman in it. And I said, well, I'm trying to figure out what to name her. And I said, she's 23 years old. So let me look and see what the most common baby names were in 1897, which I do quite frequently when I know a character's age. And there were a lot of flowers in there. And I chose Daisy. And
Okay, Daisy, Rose, yeah.
Well, I stayed with Daisy for a while, and then I thought, well, wait a minute. There's Daisy Buchanan in The Great Gatsby.
Yes, yes.
Not that anyone would ever confuse my work with F. Scott Fitzgerald, but I thought, no, I can't use Daisy. And I don't remember what I've changed it to. I haven't gone back to those notes, but she is no longer Daisy. But we need to bring back flower names again, maybe for boys.
How about Deadly Nightshade? Maybe not.
There's something similar to this book that reminds me of another book. And you said that you were walking through that area and you got the idea for the story. The same thing happened to you with the Bradford Fairfax stories, because the first one was in Provincetown.
Yes.
Am I correct?
Yes.
I'm going by memory here.
Yes, good.
You were in Provincetown and you said, I need to do a mystery here. Is this a trend with you?
Did you want me to tell that story? It's long, long-ish.
Well, no, am I correct that places trigger you?
Places trigger me very, very much, yes. And that series, which if I live long enough to write them all, I've got 8 books planned, of which four are finished. Each one takes place at a LGBTQ resort of some sort, international. So Vanished in Vallarta, Bonton Roulet, which is Palm Springs, and there would be a Frisco Follies, I'm forgetting one or two of the others. And also Lake on the Mountain, the first Dan Sharp book, came when I sailed past this promontory, and I asked the people on the boat, I said, what's up there? And they said, oh, that's Lake on the Mountain. I said, yeah, but what's up there? I feel something. So, not to get too mystical, but I think places speak to us if we will take the time to stop and listen to what they're saying. I don't remember who said it, but I've never forgotten this quotation. I think it was a musician who said, there are more stories and more entertainment in a single block in New Orleans than all of Manhattan put together. And I believe that. I believe that very much.
Well, I'm going to shock you and tell you I've never been to New Orleans.
time to come.
And my husband is Creole, so.
Wow, okay.
Go figure.
Okay.
Go figure. There's another line that was in this book that really jumped out at me, and this isn't necessarily a literary discussion. It just made me think. And that is, it wasn't Violet that said it. It's a discussion topic that the women are having about murder. And one of the women suggests that men kill out of a desire to possess, while women kill out of jealousy. And why that jumped out at me was, wouldn't you say that jealousy comes from possessiveness? That's my thought. What do you think?
I was thinking of possession perhaps in the broader sense, so property, things like that, not necessarily, but that does turn other people into property if you're killing because you want to possess a person. But certainly there is a fear that you're going to lose something. So I would turn it more on fear than jealousy in that respect, the possessive aspect.
Yeah, I guess that's where a lot of abusive relationships come from, is that fear of being alone.
Being alone, also somebody's going to leave you and take half your income, that sort of thing. Yeah.
So I want to go back to your diversity. I kind of spelled all this out in the beginning, but I'm going to do it again. You write mystery novels. You've been in theater. You directed Agatha Christie's Mousetrap for 3 years in Toronto. You're a poet, songwriter, a singer. I've seen two of your three films, and what I find interesting is My Heart Belongs to Daddy is a type of film, and then you also did a documentary, Blossom, A Portrait of Lila Kanya. What do you think it is about you that makes you so diverse?
I'm easily bored.
Because those two films couldn't be any more different.
That's a how-to rather than a why. I like to get to the heart of things. I really like to know what's inside of something, no matter how simple it is. I want to know what does it mean to be at the center of that, to embody that. So that's how I can be diverse. I'm being a little flippant when I say I'm easily bored. It is true, but that is what drives the research, the discovery that says, okay, this is something that looks like this on the surface. What happens when I dig underneath? How do I get there? So that is why sometimes I will explore something in a book format, sometimes in poetic format, sometimes in film format, sometimes in a musical format. There was a time when I wanted to be a dancer. I had to put a couple of things on the shelf. So that was one of them that went quite early on, was the dancing aspirations. I also wanted to be a doctor at one point, and I'm, you know, terrified of blood, so that just didn't work out at all.
Yeah, kind of hard there. So do you come from a creative family?
Hard to answer that. I think the simple answer is yes. My father was an accordionist and a bodybuilder.
Oh, wow.
So speaking of diverse, my mother was someone who loved painting. She did a couple of watercolors when she was younger. To my child's eye, they were miraculous. I remember seeing them. They were on shelves in our cottage. I grew up in Sudbury in Middle Ontario, and we had a cottage on Long Lake. And they had these. My mother had done watercolors, landscapes, and put them up on the shelves. And I was just crazy about them. I thought they were wonderful. There was also a 78 Victrola record player there with a box full of 78 RPMs that I would put on and listen to this, you know, old time music. And I said, don't ever get rid of the cottage, but if you do, I want the Victrola and I want the paintings. And they sold it all lock, stock, and barrel, and I never got either. But that's a long answer to your question. But I think there was artistic interest. But in those, both my parents grew up in the Depression. You know, they grew up in poor families. You didn't sit down and say, oh, I think I'll become a painter or this or that or the other, because it just was not. What's the word I want, Brad? Practical. It was not a practical thing to do. So whatever expression there might have been artistically was put on the side, but at least it was expressed. I still remember fiddling with the keys on my father's accordion and you know, trying. I wasn't big enough to squeeze it and play. So he would kind of squeeze it for me and I would play fiddle with the keys on it. But that didn't last. But I do remember the accordion, and he was talking about his music lessons, and my mother was talking about her interest in painting. And interestingly enough, my mother collected ceramic mushrooms that are now famous, worldwide famous. They came from the place in Nova Scotia where she was born. They were probably, you know, like $2 each back then. But it was a Danish couple who had moved, the Lorenzen mushrooms, they're called, if anybody's interested. And they made life-like, life-size mushrooms. And those are now they're now fetching upwards of $600 or $700 each. These things that nobody makes anymore. So that I think they both passed in the 90s. I think that was their name, or that was their studio. I'm not quite sure what. So there was always artistic interest. And my mother later on took to decorating wood. I don't know if she actually put the wood, like a little, you know, little wooden napkin holders that she would paint. She would decorate them. So there was always that interest in the arts on their part.
I was on a podcast right after my first novel came out. Actually, it wasn't a podcast. It was a radio station. And the host said, "Is anybody else in your family creative?" And I'm like, "No." And he kept digging. I'm like, "No, I can't think of anybody that writes or paints or anything in my family." And he came back to it every 5 minutes. He couldn't let it go. And I'm like, "I don't know. I like to paint. I like to write. I don't know why nobody else in the family does those things. I can't explain it." But he wouldn't let it go. It was hysterical.
Did you get an answer?
I actually stumbled.
Did he know something? Maybe he knew your great uncle twice removed? Or
no. I don't know if he had nothing else to talk about, or he just found that unbelievable. I really don't know. You know, I'm the youngest of seven kids. You would think some of them would have some artistic pursuits, but they don't. So anyway, do you mind if we talk a little bit about My Heart Belongs to Daddy?
Sure. But before we get there, I just want to say one thing. I apologize if I kicked your ass too bad when I was talking about your book. I guess it was a couple of years ago now. I thought I was just giving you good advice, but you know what? I'm like my mother. I'm known for hitting the nail right on the head, saying, "Do this, it will be better," right? Not meaning to knock people off their center or their pedestal or whatever they're on, just saying, "I see it this way," and I am kind of forceful. So if I offended you, I apologize. I hope I also helped you.
You did help me, and I took no offense to it whatsoever.
Right.
It drives me crazy when people join a writer's group and then they get upset when they get critiqued. I'm like, "What the hell are you here for? Just go home and tell yourself it's great." You know, and no, you were not harsh.
Great. Because believe me, I went through all of that. I mean, you know, imagine writing a 1,000-page novel and somebody said, "It's too long. Forget it, kid."
No, I thank you. It was good information and I took it to heart. The reason I want to bring up My Heart Belongs to Daddy is I found it very interesting. And just so the listener will know, it's a young man named Lenny who obviously was kicked out of his home because he's gay and he wants to get into drag. And he's talking to a bartender, I guess is the owner of the club.
Sophie, yes.
Yes, okay. And he said, Lenny asked about a dress. He wanted to buy a dress and he said, "I can't afford it." What he was told was, "What's more important, paying rent or being a queen?" And of course, the answer was, being a queen is more important. Is there any personal philosophy in there?
Well, I guess yes. I wouldn't have said so at the time, but I remember back in my 40s when I was struggling to succeed as a writer, and I just stopped and I thought, well, you know, I have to stop taking all these jobs that take all my time and effort if I really want to be a writer. I made that choice that I was not going to pursue another career that was non-artistic and would take me totally away from the writing. I had been a mildly successful television producer at the time, nothing extraordinary, but I remember thinking, okay, I'm contemplating another 6 months contract. I know I won't write a single word. I'm always too tired at the end of the day when I get home. So what's it going to be? And I made that choice that my work would have to come second to my writing. So yes, so, you know, I did.
So being a queen is more important.
Being a queen is more important. Queen of the publishing world, whoever that is.
Well, I don't know why I tend to get philosophical with you. I guess that's why I sent you that book on Buddhism. But in this film, nobody is very nice to each other. None of the characters are very nice to each other at all. It's a drag queen competition, and two of them, Big Bertha was one, and then Lenny, the protagonist, who is Miranda on stage, they were pretty good. The rest were terrible. Just, they were terrible at lip sync, and they looked bored. And I'm guessing that was on purpose, because it was very clear.
Yeah.
And of course, there was the usual backstage bitchiness amongst drag queens. It was a very strange 20 minutes, and I don't mean that in a negative sense. But it was. I saw that you got money from
Canada Council.
Or maybe
it was the Ontario Arts Council. I don't remember now.
No, it was the Canada Arts Council, whatever that's actually called. You got it from national government. What was its purpose? What were you trying to say in that 20-minute film?
Oh, it came out of film school. I was, you know, floundering because I couldn't make it as a writer. I couldn't make it as this. I couldn't make it as that. So I went back to film school in the late 90s, and I had written a story called Queen for a Day, which was basically the story that became My Heart Belongs to Daddy. And it was a fun little short story. It did get published. Our year-end project was to create a script for a half-hour film. So I thought, okay, I'm not going to start from scratch. I'm going to take something I've already written so I can, you know, be ahead of the game. So I very easily turned that into a script. And then someone said, hey, why don't you try to film it? And I thought, no, I can't do it. I don't have the money for that. And someone else said, well, apply for a grant. And I thought, okay, what the hell? And lo and behold, the grant came in. And I thought it was just enough to pay for the film. This was not video, by the way. This was film, which was a lot of money to process and to print. And we paid everybody on the shoot as well, like all of the actors, all of the technical people.
And that was actually pretty obvious. It was a pretty big production. I was impressed when I saw that it was a small independent film that you made. I was expecting people coming out of cardboard boxes as their homes and that sort of thing. And it was nothing like that. It was well done in production sense.
Thank you. I had some phenomenal people working on it. Yeah. And one of the fun things was all of the cast were non-professionals. All of the actors were not union actors, because I wouldn't have been able to afford that.
Were the drag queens all drag queens?
Only two of them. Big Bertha was one, who became kind of a celebrity and still is, Crystal Light. And
I love that.
I'm struggling with the name, but the Asian actor who has since died, unfortunately, she was also a professional drag queen, a very serious one and a very good one. And one of the nicest people I've ever worked with. I know I gave her a lot of bitchy lines, but she would never have done that in real life.
Yeah, she was a real bitch.
Yeah.
Before I let you go, I want to talk to you about the tour you did this year with Felice Picano. This was your first major outing since the pandemic started, wasn't it?
Oh, it certainly was. Yeah. In terms of book culture, I had been to England. I was one of the first people, as soon as the borders were open, I just ran to England in October last year. My head was exploding. I thought I need to get out of all of this. And that was the best thing I did, even though it was a little daring. But I was, made sure I was protecting myself and I wasn't endangering anybody else. But I just thought, no, I have to get out. But in terms of going around to stores and reading to audiences, that was the first major thing that I had done. Prior to that, a month prior, I had done the launch for Threads, the poetry. But this was with Felice. We each had two books to promote. And the tour took us from Toronto. We had a couple of dates in Toronto. Peterborough, which is an hour and a half from here, to Ottawa, the nation's capital, and finished in Montreal. And it was, boy, did it feel good to do that, just to, you know, get out and see people again and sign books in person and talk about what, you know, read and talk about the things we love to talk about. I won't speak for Felice, but I'm pretty sure he had as good a time as I did. And we both reconnected with friends that we hadn't seen in 2 or 3 years. That was another bonus. Him here, because he hadn't been to Toronto since, I think, 2019. Also in Peterborough, he had friends that he hadn't seen for a while. And he had, in fact, now that I think of it, he had friends everywhere. He's a very popular guy. Toronto, he did a night in Stratford that I wasn't part of. Peterborough, Ottawa, and Montreal, he had friends everywhere. I connected with people. Obviously, I'd been in touch with my friends here, but in Peterborough and Ottawa and Montreal, it was a great feeling of getting out and doing what we love and reconnecting with audiences and people and friends. So it was very, very good for both of us.
Yeah, the only times I've heard you read your work was online, which we all were doing for the past few years, which isn't the same. And I just picture you in a bookstore or whatever venue reading your work and people sitting there engrossed. I just picture you really eating that up.
I like it when it works, and most of the time it works. I won't say I'm not nervous. I'm always nervous, but I know how to channel that energy into just being interesting and being funny. I mean, that's, you know, I'm good at that. I can throw off a one-liner. We also, particularly here, we had a friend of mine, Trevor McNaughton, who is an actor, but also a literary buff. I mean, he might know more about literature than I do, and I don't say that lightly. And he is a very, very funny guy. So he brought out the best in me, the best in Felice, and the best in the audience as well. So it was a real pleasure to do that. In Peterborough, we were guests of a theater. The theater director was a friend of Felice's. And in Ottawa, I hooked up again with another friend of mine, James K. Moran, who is an amazing horror writer. Again, a wonderful host. He hosted the evening. And we ended up in Montreal with another wonderful host, a gay Montreal writer named Christopher Dorado, who I don't want to categorize him. He's just a great writer. But we were really privileged to spend time at Librairie Saga Bookstore in NDG, which is Notre-Dame-de-Grâce in Montreal. And the guys who ran it were Ilya and Mathieu, and they just made us feel so at home. I just want to go back there and do another reading event there as soon as I can. So that was all very nice. It was such a great way to end the tour and just feel really accomplished after, you know, 2.5 years of what are we going to do with our lives, you know?
Well, going back to philosophical, I'm curious about the name of the tour. It's called Our Dark Corners and Yours Tour.
The books were pretty heavy, I have to say. So Threads, I read from Threads. Mm-hmm. And I read from the last Dan Sharp book, Lion's Head Revisited. Mm-hmm. Felice was reading from His City on a Star, his sci-fi, the second installment of that, as well as Pursuit, the Victorian I want to call it a thriller. I think that he would agree with that. It's it's a fun romp, but all of those books were at their core. They were a little bit dark, but you know, with characteristic gay humor. So when we could sneak it in.
Well, once again, I want to thank you again for being on the show. I'm really glad I had you as my final guest on Queer Writers of Crime.
Brad, I couldn't be more pleased than to be your final guest. And I know that you and I will meet in person one day, but these last few years of connecting with you and making a friendship grow without actually meeting in person has been an extraordinary experience. So thank you very much.
Well, I know meeting in person was in the works and then this damn thing happened and we will make it happen soon. So when the new show Queer We Are starts, you'll need to come and listen to that as well. But I want to remind everybody, I am talking to Jeffrey Round. He is the author of the Bradford Fairfax mystery series, the Dan Sharp mystery series, and his upcoming book is Sulphur Springs Cure, which is a little ways off, but it's coming.
And can I just plug the publisher is Cormorant Books. And I'm pleased to be back with them because they have they published the Bradford Fairfax books, the early ones, as well as The Honey Locust, the Bosnian War novel. So thrilled to be back with a really, really terrific editor named Mark Cote.
Great. You went right back to where you started from. Almost.
Almost.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Bye for now.